64. Zig gripped the corner of the motel's thick TV like he was using it to stand. What Nola said. Did he believe her? Did it make sense? Part of it did. Back at Dover, someone made sure the body was switched. Someone purposely rushed the wrong fingerprints and dental records through the system. Someone even knocked Zig out on the morning when the other bodies arrived. Houdini was a stranger, a fast-talking thug. No way could he pull all that off, not without help. Whoever snuck Houdini into our building. Zig paused, rerunning the logic. It could have been anyone. There are thousands of people on base. Nola didn't say anything, still focused on the watch. Don't give me that look. My friends, Dino, Master Guns, even Amy Wags. They wouldn't do that, Zig added, now pacing. It could have been anyone. Nola sat there in the bed, hitting buttons, the watch beeping. Colonel Sue. Her I'd believe, Zig continued, carefully watching Nola's reaction. But it's gotta be someone who knows about the ways we ID people. She still didn't say a word. Heading for the nightstand, Zig picked up the landline. Who are you calling? Nola challenged. He put the phone back down. He wasn't even sure. What do you want, Mr. Zigarowski? In alphabetical order? I want to know what the hell is going on. I want to know every single person who's chasing us. Who was that Native American woman? The one who shot you and tried to murder us? The Curtain. That's her name? The Curtain. That's what he called her. Never seen her until today. I'm guessing she's a hired gun. Hired by who? Nola went quiet, letting out a low, deep breath. Houdini. At just the name, Zig's brain flipped back to what Caesar said about Houdini's old blue book. About the three aliases on the plane. A small group that no one ever realized was there. Zig could feel the pieces starting to fit together at the far edges. But even so, the way Nola said his name, there was newfound anger in her voice. So you know him, Zig said. I didn't say that. You haven't said anything. In case you didn't notice, I saved your life. I didn't ask for your help. And yet, I still gave it. According to most dictionaries, that's called generosity. Or kindness. Some might see it as stupidity, but I prefer something a bit more benevolent. Nola sat there, silent, now sketching something on the motel notepad. She didn't look mad. She looked lost in her thoughts. That's how you process, isn't it? By drawing, Zig asked. Still no response. I had a coworker who used to do that. He'd have to draw a picture of how the deceased would eventually look before he could start working on them. Liar. You just made that up. Zig nodded. It was a lie. A white one. Designed to gain some trust. But once again, she'd seen right through it. He wanted to be annoyed. But he was actually impressed. Nola, if I were working against you, we wouldn't even be having this conversation right now. Back to silence. Back to her sketching. Okay, let's try it this way, Zig added. Let me tell you what I know. And then you sit there and draw whatever it is you're drawing and we'll see where it gets us. Okay. First, I know for sure you had a seat on a military plane in Alaska. I know for sure you didn't get on that plane. Maybe you saw something and had a quick thought. Maybe someone saw you and you took off. However it happened, you gave that seat to a woman named Camille. Maybe Camille was a longtime friend, or maybe someone you recently met. I told you, I didn't know her well. You knew her well enough to paint her portrait. Nola again went quiet. Regardless, from the way you came looking for Camille's body, you didn't know that plane was going down. Neither did Camille, until it was too late. And that also tells me, for sure, that Camille had some idea of what you were worried about, because during her last moments on a plane that was falling from the sky, Camille ate a sheet of paper with a warning message for you. So if all that's true, which I believe it is, that means that whatever brought you to Alaska, while you were there, you uncovered something. Something that I'm wagering is called Operation Blue Book. If I knew what Blue Book was, I wouldn't be hiding in a motel. But you know who Houdini is. Is he the one in charge? Nola shook her head. He's just a paying agent. A what? Paying agents. They make payments. That's the job. Payments to who? Depends what our government needs. Sometimes an army unit needs a hot tip. Other times we need a toilet paper contract so our troops can wipe. Usually, though, it's just quiet money. I have no idea what quiet money means. Still sketching, Nola explained years ago in Iraq, one of our tank drivers read his map wrong and mistakenly plowed over a farmer's herd of goats. Another time, our mortar men accidentally bombed the wrong building, sending bricks flying and injuring half a dozen innocents. When disasters like that happen, and they always happen, the paying agent comes in to make restitution with the locals. So he's a guy with cash. Again, that's the job. Most soldiers carry an M4 rifle. The paying agent carries a far more potent weapon. A briefcase full of money. He can make payments up to 30K, no questions asked. A supervisor can get him above that. To go above 100K, he needs to clear it with the Department of Defense. That's a lot of currency for one person. Consider it the cost for good PR. If we've got an army unit sneaking into town, the last thing we need is to call attention to ourselves. Or even worse, have some local farmer reveal our location while we're still in the initial stages of an operation. You can make a lot of peace with a lot of cash. So Houdini, his real name was Rowan Johansson. Okay, Rowan. He was one of these paying agents. One of the best. When a Humvee hits a farmer's handmade rock fence, you call for a paying agent. But when that Humvee hits something more valuable, you call Rowan. What's more valuable? Like hitting someone's house? Like killing someone's child, Nola said, looking up. Zig stood there, not blinking. She continued to stare, which Zig was starting to realize she did quite often. She had the wary eyes of an old woman, and they were always perfectly focused, picking life apart. Indeed, even now, as she talked about the death of someone's child, she turned that focus straight toward Zig, searching him for a reaction. For Zig, though, there wasn't one. Despite the loss of his daughter, he knew how life worked. He saw death all the time. Every week, he'd stand over a gurney, putting flesh makeup on a gray body, prepping yet another young soul who was cut down in his prime. I see it every day, he told her. No, you see it after the hurricane hits, Nola said. Imagine the moment itself. When a Sunni mom comes running down a dirt road, yelling in Arabic that our unit just left live ordnance around, which was found by her now-dead 5-year-old son. I couldn't understand the dialect, but I'll never forget that woman's screams. Anguish sounds the same worldwide. What's your point? You asked about Rowan Johansson. That's what he does. People are horrified when you put a price on a child's life. But in a small Sunni town, for a male child, which are valued there more than females. When you calculate lifespan, add the fact they can work until they're 80 years old, then compound it all as an annual salary, that dead boy will cost Uncle Sam about $72,000. pay the poor family in cash, and abracadabra, the problem goes away. She paused as she said the words. Now you understand why they call him Houdini. He makes the biggest mistakes. Disappear, Zig said, as Nola went back to sketching on her notepad. To Zig, the story made sense, and matched up even more with what he'd heard back at the magic shop. Houdini seemed to be spending a great deal of time moving cash, and lately, according to the amazing Caesar, appeared to be moving more of it than usual, including a big shipment from Alaska. Which begged the question, what was going on in Alaska that they had a sudden influx in cash? Did all the extra cash mean that someone was asking Houdini to cover up an even bigger problem? And more important, how'd this all tie in to Nola, that crashed airplane, and Operation Blue Book? Glancing over at Nola, Zig noticed the way she was holding her pen, like she was strangling it. Nola, if there's anything else you know, I know Houdini, like any special ops paying agent, specializes in disasters, especially the ones that the Army doesn't want anyone to hear about. That's all I know. So could that be what Operation Blue Book is? Maybe that's why he was in Alaska. Maybe Blue Book isn't the process of making big things go away. Maybe instead of being a slush fund, Blue Book is its own private mission. And in the midst of it, they made a mistake that they now need to cover up. Still sketching, Nola didn't say anything. Or maybe someone accidentally found out that Houdini was covering Blue Book up. Or, Zig said, still letting the facts tumble through his brain, maybe when Houdini saw all the cash he was being sent, maybe he started taking his own private cut. Is that possible? How much did you say a paying agent carries around with him? More silence. You know, Nola, if you want to figure out what's going on, it might be helpful to actually speak to each other. She continued to sketch. Zig wanted to be mad, but he knew silence like that was trained into her. Zig cleared his throat and craned his neck, trying to get a look at what Nola was drawing. She turned away, just slightly, making it clear she wasn't sharing. Nola, if it makes you feel better, I figured out your art. That's what brought you to Alaska, right? I know why you went there. Nola glanced up, but not for long. She was about to say the word, liar. I saw them, Zig interrupted, in your office. All those portraits you painted. The canvases that were leaning against each other. There were dozens of them. Soldiers from the chest up. They're really beautiful when you look at them. But also pretty sad, Zig added, searching her face for a reaction. On the back of each one, I noticed you always listed the soldier's name. Daniel Graff, Monterey, California. Sergeant Denise Madigan, Kuwait. Nola's sketching slowed down. Not by much, but enough. Come on, Nola. All it took was an internet connection. Once I got pictures of them, did you really think I wouldn't figure out what all your paintings had in common? You don't know what your attempted suicide, Zig blurted. That's it, isn't it? Every artist in residence has her own motif. Years ago, during the wind down in Afghanistan, one of the artists used to just paint landscape scenes of our troops leaving the desert. Painting after painting of piles of computers we left behind, holes where our HQs used to be, bulldozers that took our old bases apart. Other artists focused on people, painting soldiers in the field. But you, Daniel Graff, Sergeant Madigan, you paint those service members who tried to take their own lives. Nola sat there in the bed. She was no longer sketching.
65. Deutsch Air Base, Copper Center, Alaska, 5 days ago.
How much longer?
Camille asked. Soon, Nola said, a pastel crayon in her hand.
Stop talking.
Camille shifted in her seat, a plastic folding chair they took from the PX. Nola sat across from her, peeking out from behind her canvas every few seconds.
Come on, Sergeant Brown, can you at least tell me how I look?
Nola grunted, still trying to figure it out. She took another glance. Camille squinted when she talked, like she was always asking for a favor. That was the secret. Her flat nose was easy, but for Nola, nothing was right until she captured Camille's squint.
So this painting thing, you've done it with other people, yeah? People who tried to... who did what I...
Camille's voice trailed off. No one liked to say suicide.
You've met a lot of us, huh?
It's not a club, Nola shot back, using her finger to blend the beige pastel into the canvas.
The other people you've met, Sergeant Brown, how did they do? You know, after they...
Again, her voice trailed off. Nola usually despised small talk. But she liked this girl. Camille wasn't some self-hating cloud of doom. She was sharp, funny, even teased Nola for her subject matter, saying,
maybe next time you can paint something less depressing, like a sad clown series, a dead kitten collection, or still life with gun to head.
Even Nola grinned at that. What you've been through, Nola said. Think of it as life's second chance. She dabbed the pastel some more. Some people come back even stronger. Camille sat up straight. A second chance. She liked that.
I'm gonna be one of those people.
Nola nodded, cursing her pastels for not doing what they were told. She wouldn't be happy until she finished Camille's eyes.
So the army really pays you to paint?
Camille asked. I'm assigned. It's a mission.
Still, to draw like that. You're gonna make me immortal, huh?
Nola made a face.
I'm serious, Sergeant Brown. In 100 years, thanks to your art, I'll still exist.
66. Maryland. Today.
I'm right, aren't I?
Nola ignored the question. Sitting there on the motel's saggy bed, she was pretending to sketch.
You know I'm right. That's why you went to Alaska, isn't it?
Zig added.
Every morning at that base in Virginia, you'd come into your office and scour the nightly blotter reports from each base. Then one day you saw it in some outpost in Alaska, reports of a T-14.91, attempted suicide, and you went running. That's how you met Camille.
Nola still didn't reply.
Usually no one gave it much notice, Zig said. That's the artist's job, right? You come in, paint a few pictures, and leave. That's the job. Your boss told me back at your office. The army gives you the right to go wherever you want. But when you arrived in Alaska, maybe Camille told you something. Maybe you saw it yourself. Whatever happened, though, something just didn't seem right, did it? You realized it as you were going to leave. Something on that base was just a little bit off.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Actually, for the first time, I think I finally do,
Zig said, his voice now racing.
What'd you see out there, Nola? A crime? Or maybe just something that caught your eye, made you dig a little bit deeper? Either way, you realized what they were up to.
I still have no idea what they're up to. I don't know what Blue Book is.
But that's why you stayed. Look at the timeline. You met Camille and painted her picture. Your job was done. You had a seat on that plane and should have been on that flight that was leaving Alaska. But then you got that naughty feeling in your gut. It happened after you painted Camille. Maybe she said it while she was sitting for you. Something told you there was a better story if you stuck around, maybe a better painting even. All you had to do was stay. So at the very last minute, you got off the plane, gave your seat to Camille.
I didn't give her anything. She begged me for it.
But that's why you went to Alaska, isn't it? To paint Camille's portrait? She's the one who tried to kill herself.
I brought her joy. My painting, it made her happy. She loved it so much she begged me to keep it. Then she begged me again to take my spot on the plane. She was trying to see her fiancé.
And the next thing you know, just as you're starting to snoop around, the plane plummets from the sky. And now you realize your gut was right.
He paused, letting it sink in. Sitting in bed, Nola stared straight ahead, refusing to look at Zig, focusing on a peeling section of southwestern tribal pattern wallpaper. Her pen was still in her hand, but it wasn't anywhere near the pad of paper.
Nola, before you blame yourself,
why'd you protect me before?
Nola blurted. Zig looked at her, confused.
Back in the insurance shop, with the grenade. When the curtain threw it, you jumped on me and tipped the table to protect us.
I thought you were unconscious.
I was awake, she shot back, still staring straight ahead. If that grenade went off...
The grenade wasn't real.
You didn't know that. If it went off, the shrapnel would have ripped through you. I'm asking you a question, Mr. Zigarowski. Why'd you risk yourself for me?
A long, weighty silence took the room. Zig stood there between the two twin beds. The air was so quiet he heard the running water through the pipes and the cycling of the toilet. He shrugged.
Why'd you do what you did at the campfire?
He took a deep breath.
It just seemed like the right thing. I didn't want you to get hurt.
Nola paused.
Is this about your daughter? Or me? She asked.
A new silence took hold, a far deeper silence as the air itself grew heavy and thick. It was the kind of silence that came not just from a lack of sound, but a lack of movement. In his ears, Zig heard a high-pitched hum, like in the embalming room. For a minute, Zig stood there, swaying just slightly. His voice was barely a murmur.
I don't know.
In the bed, Nola was still looking straight ahead, staring at nothing in particular.
Horatio, she announced.
What?
That's him. He's the one, Nola explained. Back on the boat, I got his name. That's who Houdini reports to, the real string puller behind Operation Blue Book.
So he...
He's the one who hired the curtain, ordered the plane crash, and murdered Camille. They call him Horatio.
67. Am I supposed to recognize that name? Zig asked. Horatio, Nola repeated. It's the name of another magician. Like a modern magician, or from the 1800s, Nola said, climbing out of bed and standing there a moment to get her bearings. She blinked a few times, lightheaded from the blood loss. She headed for the bathroom, sat down, and peed with the door open. Zig looked away, though he still caught an unwanted glimpse of her in the mirror above one of the dressers. So this Horatio, where's my gun? I saw you grab it, she said, still in her underwear and a bra as she opened and shut the shower curtain, then stepped back into the room and did the same with the closet. She ran her fingers across the top shelf as well as the headboard of each bed. Then she opened every drawer in each of the two dressers. No one knows we're here, Zig insisted, eyeing the way her white hair ran down, covering the scars on her upper back. But it couldn't obscure all of them. She wasn't thin. She was muscular, like a boxer. And the way she was moving, favoring her left hand, she was working hard to hide it. But she was in pain. Where's my gun? I put it in the trunk of the car. Nola stared at him a moment, studying his face. Then she turned to the mattress, lifting it from the box spring. Underneath was her gun, exactly where Zig had hidden it. She shot Zig a look and climbed back into bed. As she sat there Indian style, Zig couldn't avoid her underwear. Maybe you could cover yourself up, he suggested. She didn't. Instead, she was focused on her gun, quickly field-stripping the pistol. Within seconds, she ejected the magazine and pulled off the slide and guide rod, then inspected the feed ramp and the grooves inside the barrel. Can we please get back to Horatio? Zig asked. During the Civil War, Horatio G. Cook was a well-known rope escapist, she explained, still working on the gun. So much so that his skills caught the attention of a man named Abraham Lincoln. Is this for real? Look it up. President Lincoln was so impressed, he had two generals and a senator tie up young Horatio, who was just 18 at the time. When Horatio escaped, Lincoln made him an offer, asking him to personally work for Lincoln in the war. So he was Lincoln's spy? Officially, they called him a scout. But yes, Horatio was sneaky, a secret weapon, which is what Lincoln needed back then. Soon after, Horatio started working for the Union, and when he saved his scouting party from capture, he and Lincoln actually became friends. According to what I found online, on the night Abraham Lincoln was shot, Horatio Cook was one of the people in Ford's Theater, and one of the very few by Lincoln's bedside when the president died. I've never heard of this guy. Neither had I, Nola confessed, already done putting the gun back together. She racked the slide to make sure all was working. What makes the story even more memorable is that after Lincoln died, Horatio continued to do magic, continued to work for the government, and also turned his attention to exposing fake mediums. By the time he was an old man, he even befriended an up-and-coming magician named, don't say Harry Houdini. Nola was still staring down at the gun, like Zig wasn't even there. I couldn't make this up if I wanted to. So, in real life, you're telling me Houdini and Horatio were friends? Zig asked. Friends and fellow magicians. And from what I can tell, they both traveled around the country exposing anyone who claimed they could talk to the dead. Apparently, they both lost people close to them and weren't ever able to move past it. Looking to his left, Zig studied his own warped reflection in the curve of the motel's old TV. You said the real Horatio worked for Abraham Lincoln. Did the real Houdini have any connections to presidents? Nola looked up from her gun. He knew Teddy Roosevelt. Also met with Woodrow Wilson, too. Why? You said Horatio was Lincoln's secret weapon. Was Houdini one, too? So now the White House has an army of undercover magicians? You're watching too much History Channel. I'm not talking about an army. I'm talking about a single magician. Someone whose specialty is doing exactly what you said this guy Rowan Johnson, using the code name Houdini, was doing in the army. Making very big problems disappear. Nola thought about that. Zig did too. A century ago, the real Horatio and real Houdini spent quality time with the most powerful men in the world. And now, today, this modern Horatio and Houdini were using them as namesakes, moving loads of cash, and were ruthlessly determined to keep a lid on whatever was really going on in Alaska. Whatever they were up to, they were definitely covering. The big move covers the small one, Zig blurted. Nola shot him a look. It's a magician saying, Zig explained, suddenly picturing President Orson Wallace barely 2 days ago, during his surprise visit to Dover, heading down the back of the plane and carrying the transfer case with his dead pal's remains. The whole world was watching Wallace, including every single person at Dover. But no one was watching the president's friend. Abracadabra, Zig muttered, thinking about his visit to the magic shop. Pulling out his phone, he opened a browser and quickly typed three words into Google: Houdini and Nelson Rookstool. The big move covers the small one. What if? Zig started speaking before he even had the full thought. Then he saw what popped up on screen. I don't believe it, he added, scrolling and trying to speed read. They have everything. His letters, his playbills, even his... He looked up at Nola. When Harry Houdini died, guess what government agency got all his books and papers? The Library of Congress. Wait, you knew that? Nola nodded. She'd looked it up days ago. He owned one of the largest libraries in the world on psychic phenomena, spiritualism, magic, Zig read from the site, and returning from the dead. There is no return from the dead, Nola said. Not literally. But think about it. We know one magician worked for Abraham Lincoln. From there, it sounds like the real Harry Houdini also did undercover work for the government. So if you were the president and you wanted to make sure no one found out about your favorite secret program, would you put it in the White House, the Pentagon, or would you hide it in some lesser-watched government location where no one would ever look? Nola started sketching again as Zig stared down at the website for the Library of Congress. Maybe that's why Nelson Rookstuhl was on the plane. In fact, maybe that's why the president appointed him, Zig added, his voice at full speed. If the leader of the free world goes to Alaska, the whole world watches. But if the Librarian of Congress goes there, stay with Horatio. Just listen. Houdini donated all his books to the Library of Congress for a reason. What if that's the home base for Operation Bloop? Horatio's our focus, Nola growled. Zig turned. Her face was red, her fists clenched. Silent Nola was no longer silent. Confused, Zig asked, Don't you want to know what Blue Book is? I don't give a turd. You give a turd. What I want are the people who put that plane down. I got Houdini. So Horatio, whoever he is, they murdered 7 people. They killed Camille. They were trying to kill me. Flicks of spit left Nola's lips as she said the words. Zig just stood there, at the foot of the twin beds, watching her catch her breath. In all the time they'd been together, she was an expert at being quiet. Now she was smoldering. Back at the insurance place, Zig convinced himself that when it came to killing Houdini, Nola had no choice. It was self-defense. Now, he wasn't so sure. Nola, as you track this guy Horatio, when you finally find him, what are you planning to do to him? Nola didn't answer. She didn't have to. Zig knew. Deep down, he always knew. For Nola, this wasn't about Operation Blue Book, or a government cover-up, or even the dead innocents on that plane. It was about revenge. I'm telling you right now, Zig added, whoever Horatio is, killing him won't solve anything. Nola was still silent, staring straight down at the reassembled gun in front of her. And just so you know, I'm not helping you commit murder, Zig said. Still no response. Zig thought about calling the cops, or someone at the FBI, maybe even Colonel Sue's commanding officer, the general in charge of Dover. But at his core, Zig was all too aware of this unarguable truth. Whoever he turned Nola over to, wherever they locked her up, her real name would eventually be put in the system. Once that happened, some bad folks who were looking for her would quickly find her. And once that happened, wherever Nola was being hidden, that wouldn't be a place she'd be walking away from. Ever. If you have something to say, just say it, Mr. Zigarowski. Why are you still here? Zig blurted. Her dark eyes slid his way. I mean it, he said. I stopped your shoulder from bleeding. I patched you up. I even got you a sweatshirt from the lost and found at the front desk. It's a size too big, but if you put it on, it'll do the job. Every other time I've seen you, you leave as fast as you can. Even now, you could have darted outside and stolen my car, or just slipped away while I was cleaning the blood from your coat. But for some reason, you're still sitting here, staring down at your gun, which is out of bullets. So tell me, Nola, why are you still here? much less putting up with all my questions. With a clench of her feet, Nola cracked her toe knuckles. Because you're the one who can get me on that plane. Zig was confused. What plane? In her right hand, Nola picked up the notepad she'd been drawing in. She held it up, giving Zig his first good look at what she'd been sketching. The Sunto watch. Nola had drawn it over and over, each watch showing a digital time, a few letters, and a 10-digit number. You did these by memory? Or did you copy them down? Zig asked. She didn't answer, but as Zig looked closer, he could see that all the letters and numbers were different, each representing its own grid based on latitude and longitude. You know where Horatio is, don't you? Silent Nola didn't say a word. Until. I need you to get me on that plane, Mr. Zigarowski. Nola, this isn't please. Listen. I know where Horatio's hiding. I need you to get me to Alaska.
68. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. It was the morning after she found the old letters. Royal was in the kitchen, flipping through a glossy magazine for high net worth individuals that Mr. Wesley had given him. Dream it to live it, and eating his peanut butter on toast. He was up early. On a Sunday. That was her first sign something was wrong. Nola kept her head down, cradling Dooch in her arms. At night, the skunk slept at her feet, even hesitantly followed her to the bathroom this morning, which brought Nola a silent thrill and sense of love she'd never experienced before. She tried focusing on that, hoping that maybe Royal would stay away.
What do you want for breakfast?
Royal asked, a smile on his face. That was her second sign. He was being nice. Wasn't licking his lips either. Not drunk, not hungover. Whatever Royal was planning, whatever punishment was coming for Nola finding those letters, he was taking his time.
Just, I guess, cereal, I guess?
Coming up.
Royal grabbed a box of Lucky Charms, poured it in a bowl, even took out the milk. He poured some for Nola and some for Dooch, who had leapt down from Nola's lap and was now walking in small but meaningful circles around the edges of the milk bowl.
Mm-mm-mm,
Royal said, squatting down and making kissy noises, trying to draw the skunk closer.
That's for you. Drink up.
Dooch stayed where he was, by the milk bowl, cocking his head and adding a sour expression of judgment.
So where are you going today?
Royal asked Nola, his eyes still on the skunk.
To a friend's.
Nola knew better than to tell Royal about Ms. Sable.
She's got some toys and extra food for Dooch. A little cat bed, too.
Oh, you want a cat bed?
He baby-talked to the skunk.
Go. Drink. Yummy,
he added, motioning to the milk bowl. Dooch just stood there, not taking a sip.
Maybe you want some cheese. You want cheese?
Royal said, reaching for the refrigerator.
We should run,
Nola interrupted, scooping up Dooch and heading for the door.
Be back later.
Usually, Royal couldn't muster a goodbye. But today...
Enjoy the sunshine, he announced. It's beautiful out.
He was right. Outside, the weather was gorgeous. The sky a pastel blue that reminded Nola of an iceberg. Deep down, though, Nola knew. She could feel it in her soul. No matter how much the sun was shining, a merciless storm was on its way. 69. Mitchellville, Maryland. Today. Nola told him she was hungry. That was all it took. She said she wanted a hamburger and Zig was on it, headed for the door to get them some dinner. As Zig slid an arm into his jacket, Nola was sitting in bed, combing through the Twitter feeds of every Washington, D.C. news site, looking for mentions of the shooting, or of finding Houdini's body. back at Powell Insurance.
Still nothing?
Zig asked. Nola shook her head, still scrolling. They both knew what was happening. For a shooting to stay this quiet, it's because yet again, someone high up was working to keep it quiet. I'll keep looking, Nola said as Zig headed out. Yet as the door slammed behind him, Nola opened a new browser, typed in yellowpages.com, and clicked on the button marked Find People. From there, she entered a name she hadn't thought about in years. Lydia Konnikova, Ekron, Pennsylvania. An address and number quickly appeared on screen. Same address, Nola thought. No surprise. She clicked on the number. The phone rang three times before,
"Good evening, this is Lydia,"
a quiet and tired female voice said. "Mrs. Konnikova, this'll sound awkward and I'm not sure if you remember me, but my name is Nola Brown. When I was little, you were one of our Girl Scout moms. I'm the one," she was about to say, "who got the top of her ear cut off at the campfire."
"Nola Brown, whose dad loved those Thin Mints?" Lydia sang, the life now back in her voice.
"That's me," Nola said, remembering the fight Royal raised when, after he ate a dozen boxes of cookies, he found out how much each box cost. Naturally, he refused to pay, screaming at all involved until one of the moms paid for the Thin Mints herself just to shut him up.
"How you been getting along, sweetie? Where are you getting along? My gosh, how long's it been?"
The good news was, from the sound of it, Mrs. Konnikova hadn't heard that Nola was supposedly dead. "I'm sorry to bother you so late, ma'am," Nola said, ignoring the question. "I'm just wondering if you can help me with something. I recently ran into Jim Zigarowski."
"Ziggy? How's he doing? Where's he doing?"
"It was at a work event, ma'am," Nola said, now wondering if Mrs. Konnikova uttered anything other than questions. "I hadn't seen him in over a decade. To my surprise, he remembered me right away. So as we were catching up, I asked him how his daughter Maggie was doing, and, well..."
"Oh, dear. You didn't know she passed, did you?"
"I didn't, ma'am. I felt horrible, of course. But later that night, when I tried to find out what happened, the records for the Ekron Eagle..."
"They weren't online back then, were they?"
"That's what I'm trying to say, ma'am."
"Oh, dear. So you still don't know? No one told you?"
"I don't mean to pry. I just didn't know who else to call." Mrs. Konnikova let out a long, aching sigh.
"You have to understand, this was back when Ziggy and Charmaine were still married. It was toward the end, of course, when the fighting got heated. In fact, now that I'm saying it, this was the real height of it all, screaming and yelling about..."
She cut herself off. Nola made a mental note, knowing all too well why middle-aged couples scream at each other, especially before a divorce. Grabbing the notepad from the motel nightstand, she wrote the word, "affair." She then crossed out the question mark. No shock, considering the last hoochie Zig was dating, who Nola found when she ran his phone records.
"What I'm really getting at," Mrs. Konnikova added, "is this wasn't a good night for the Zigarowski family. From what I understood, the shouting got so bad that, well, 12-year-old girls don't like their parents screaming at full blast. So without telling anyone, young Maggie opened her bedroom window and snuck out."
"Did Mr. Zigarowski know she ran away?"
"Not for hours. They had tucked her in, thought she was asleep. But at midnight, when they saw her bed empty, any parent would be panicked."
Nola cleared her throat, staring at the notepad, tempted to draw her old bedroom. She decided against it.
"Anyway, when they realized Maggie was gone, all it did was take the fight to DEFCON 1. Maggie had run away before, during another night of arguing. She was such a good hider, it took Ziggy and Charmaine hours to find her. One time, she was nearly a mile away, hiding on some swing set in a neighbor's backyard. So you can imagine the scene on this night. They're both running through the house, calling Maggie's name. Charmaine's blaming Ziggy for yelling so loud. Ziggy's blaming Charmaine for the same. Then Ziggy, hoping to find her, he grabs his car keys, storming outside. He couldn't have any idea. You understand?"
Mrs. Konnikova added, her voice slowing down, filling with dread.
He was just worried about his daughter, determined to track her down. So in a bolt of anger, Ziggy races out to the driveway and gets in his car.
Mrs. Konnikova's voice cracks as she says the words.
But what he couldn't possibly know is that on this night, young Maggie's hiding spot was underneath the car. She'd crawled under there for some quiet and apparently had been out there so long, she fell asleep.
No, Nola whispered, not even realizing she said it out loud.
Ziggy couldn't have known. He couldn't have. He was upset in a mad panic, just a frantic father trying to find his missing daughter. So he gets into the car, throws it in reverse, and as he peels out of the driveway.
Nola's mouth gaped open, her pen hovering inches from the paper. Oh, God.
It was worse than you can imagine. According to Sheriff Vaccaro, Maggie was... They declared her dead on the scene. I remember getting the call that night. We all went over the next morning with candles and flowers, everyone in the troop putting plush unicorns outside the house since Maggie always loved unicorns.
For a full 30 seconds, Nola just sat there, mouth still sagging open, replaying every conversation she'd had with Zig over the past 2 days, every thought she had about him, rewriting and recoloring it with this new information.
I haven't seen him for years now, Mrs. Konnikova finally said. How's he holding up?
This entire time, Nola thought he looked sad. Definitely lonely. But now, he's stronger than people think.
My gosh, I remember him as so handsome, like a young Paul Newman with those eyes.
He still blames himself, though, Nola blurted.
Can you fault him? In one terrible night, his whole life disappeared. No wife, no daughter. He lost his parents years ago. The man went from everything to nothing. No one looking out for him. No one. Like they were erased. I mean, can you imagine?
Nola held the phone tight, not saying a word.
Plus, even if you can move forward after burying a child, which, let's be honest, is impossible,
Mrs. Konnikova added,
but even if you could, everyone knew Ziggy still blamed himself for all of it. For Maggie being under that car, for the fight that sent her there, even for his wife sleeping around on him.
His wife? Nola asked, eyeing the word affair on her notepad. I thought Zig was the one who had the affair.
Ziggy? No, that was Charmaine. She was sneaking off with an old high school flame. Some big shot finance guy in Philadelphia. Unfinished business and all that. Jackie Siegel said she'd just heard they're finally getting married. But Ziggy? Ugh, this planet doesn't make people as stubborn and stupidly loyal as that anymore. No, even back then when it came to his marriage, the only thing Zig did was kick himself for not seeing it coming. As a mortician here, he would get so absorbed in everyone else's losses, but there he was, completely missing his own. And then in one foul day, his life as he knew it was gone,
Konnikova said.
Truth is, I'm just happy to hear he's still standing. To live through what he lived through? Oh gosh, if I'm being honest, I worried he might have put a gun to his own head, you know?
Nola glanced down at the faded old marks on her wrist and the wound in her shoulder, which Zig spent the better part of the evening stitching and sealing. I'm glad to report his life is finally calming down.
You think you'll see him again?
Nola looked at the door. Unclear.
Well, if you do, do me a favor. Give him a big, fat hug from all of us here. I remember that last night before he moved away. There was a going-away party, all of us hiding in the back 40 bar waiting to yell, "Surprise!" His old troop even baked a Samoa cookie cake, his favorite. Of course, Ziggy never came. Again, not that I blame him. These days, I just wish he could give himself some forgiveness. He's been through enough to earn that.
20 minutes from now, Zig would return to the motel room with 3 burgers for the two of them, plus some fries and onion rings.
Everything okay?
He'd ask. Nola would nod, barely looking up. Just hungry.
70. Zig couldn't sleep. No surprise. Even on a good night, in a good room, on a good bed, Zig could never sleep in a hotel. He'd stare at the ceiling. his thoughts wandering to what other celebrations and sins other ghosts had consummated there. Tonight, though, Zig wasn't staring at the ceiling. He was eyeing Nola, who was dead asleep in the twin bed on his right. She slept on her side, her weight on her shoulder, despite the aching pain she had to be feeling. Her face was calm, however, and Zig realized it was the only time he'd ever seen her with a placid expression. When Nola was awake, her brain was working. Only in sleep did she look untroubled. It made her look younger, like a child. At 1 a.m., Zig was still awake, watching the steady rise and fall of Nola's breathing, just like he used to when Maggie was little. And now he couldn't help but wonder if Nola was right. Clearly this wasn't just about a decade-old campfire. So was he really here just because he missed his dead daughter? Was he really that simplistic, that as long as Nola was around, it made him feel like a father again? If he were in his own house, lost in his own head like this, Zig would be in his backyard, studying his beehive, his ritual beer in his hand. Then he'd go on Facebook, checking on his ex-wife. Rituals were good things to have in life. Everyone needs something they can count on, especially when you feel like no one understands. Just a few feet away, Nola's chest rose and fell again with another steady breath. Some nights, Zig couldn't bear not seeing his daughter's face. Other nights, there was no pain greater than actually seeing it. A few feet away, perched on the nightstand, were the remnant wrappers from the burgers they had for dinner, and the new prepaid phone Zig bought at CVS. If he wanted, he could use it to go online, or at least get onto Facebook. Even without signing in, he could see his ex's profile photo and marital status. If someone was watching online, they couldn't trace him. With a quick look, maybe Zig would at least get some sleep. No, he told himself. Don't be so. Zig grabbed the modern-looking flip phone. With a flip, it was open and on. All he had to do was put his ex's name into Google. Her Facebook page was the third thing that came up. Zig glanced over at Nola. Her chest rose and fell. Snapping the phone shut, Zig slid it back across the nightstand. There you go. That's the right choice. He told himself it had nothing to do with Nola. He was just tired of being so damn predictable. 10 minutes from now, when he finally fell asleep, Zig would have an old dream that he hadn't had for years. A dream where he was driving his first car, an old Mercury Capri that smelled like wet fur, with his grandfather sitting in the back seat, telling dirty jokes. In just a few hours, he'd wake up feeling lighter than he'd felt in years, ready to take on anything. The feeling wouldn't last long.
71. Homestead, Florida, 10 years ago. This was Nola when she was 16. It was supposed to be a good night, or at least an easy night. It had been a while now since the letters, making Nola think that Royal had forgotten, or at least moved on. She was waiting by the front door as Dooch rubbed against the tufted leather ottoman like it was a conjugal visit. Months ago, Royal got pulled over by the police. He thought this was it. They'd finally tracked him down. His trunk was filled with printing supplies. They'd arrest him on the spot. But as the cop came to his window, the officer explained he'd simply been caught going 40 in a school zone. Right there, Royal said a thank you to God and decided to make a change. He would go back to sales, use his skills to build a business he could actually be proud of. He even had the product. One of Mr. Wesley's clients was a wholesaler of snacks and granola bars. Sell them in bulk to office break rooms and big businesses. If you're ambitious, there's real money. Royal saw it as his second chance. In his very last act, making fake IDs, he got the new ottoman by trading a social security card and a set of phone and electric bills to the owner of a furniture store in Tampa. Royal thought it made the living room look fancy, sophisticated. When potential clients came over, they needed to see that. But as Nola was keenly aware, it had been weeks since they'd seen any clients. Tonight, though, was different. Royal had nabbed the biggest fish of all. The supply sergeant for nearby Homestead Air Base had made an introduction to her superior. Royal had gone to the base to close the deal and, more important, collect the check. A big one. According to Royal, if things went right, maybe his biggest. Something to do with the Southern Command, covering every military base in Central America, South America, and the Caribbean, he'd told Nola last night.
You know how many granola bars they go through? This is change-your-life money, he'd added, as Nola took those words and imagined what they looked like.
A brand new life.
Maybe we move closer to the base, get our own pool, Royal had said.
So tonight, as Royal's car pulled into the driveway, Nola was standing by the front door eagerly awaiting his arrival. She didn't care about Royal or whatever dumb military deal he was chasing. God knows she didn't even care about the money. Sure, Royal had made a good living selling IDs over the years, but Nola never saw any of the cash. She was just excited for the Chinese food that Royal would be bringing home tonight, and the dry cleaning that always came with it. That's how it always was when Royal got paid. For weeks, the dry cleaning would build up, too expensive to retrieve. But when Royal delivered on a big order of IDs and driver's licenses, and Mr. Wesley gave him his cash, Royal would return home with a big smile on his face, Chinese food in one hand, and a fresh stack of plastic-covered dress shirts slung over his shoulder. All hail the conquering hero. On nights like that, Royal wasn't a better person, but he might let his viciousness go for a few hours. And on a night like this, his biggest deal ever, Nola wouldn't be surprised if he had bought the whole Chinese restaurant.
Dinner's here,
Nola teasingly whispered to Dooch as Royal kicked at the front door. Of course he was kicking. His hands were full with food and dry cleaning. Finally, Royal could get rid of Mr. Wesley and build a proper business.
Coming,
Nola called out. Dooch raised his tail at attention. Smiling hopefully, Nola undid the locks. But as the door swung open, there was Royal, empty-handed. A jolt of fear ran through her as she stepped out of the way. Trudging, his shoulders sagging, Royal didn't even look at her. It seemed he wasn't even angry. He was nothing. It was like someone had hollowed him out. No cash, no deal, no Chinese food, and certainly no changing your life. As Royal reached the couch, he took off his blazer and let it fall to the floor. Then he collapsed into the cushions, his torso hunched like the letter C. Dooch leapt up next to him. For a moment, the way his body jerked as he breathed in, Nola thought Royal was about to cry, but he didn't. Throughout her years with him, especially during his early days in sales, Nola had seen Royal make deals, close deals, and lose deals, but she'd never seen him. She searched for the word, defeated.
I can make dinner,
Nola finally said. By now, she'd made peace with the fact that he took her in all those years ago, so he'd have someone to cook and clean for him. Then, for a reason she couldn't explain, she decided to join him on the couch. She didn't get close. She just sat there on the other side of him, so Royal was between her and Dooch. The three of them sat there for a while, Nola searching for something else to say. Finally, he spoke.
Yeah,
he mumbled. Go make dinner.
72. Dover, Delaware. Today. First, he'd need to hide her. Zig knew where. It was barely 5 a.m., the sky still an inkwell. They'd left the motel hours ago, Nola lying down in the back seat as they weaved toward Dover's downtown historic district, not far from the courthouse. At this hour, the quaint narrow streets were empty. Even Tiffany's Bakery wasn't open yet. You sure there's no alarm? Nola asked as they reached their destination. No alarm, Zig insisted, sneaking through the side yard of a grand 1918 white-clabbered home. With its laid-back front porch and antique carriage lights, it was the kind of house you see in a movie, a romantic comedy where the characters live in a place that you know they couldn't afford in the real world. But you don't care, because you'd love to live there yourself. Nola stared at the house, cocking her head to the side. but in the past few hours, Zig had become better at reading her. She didn't like this place. "Don't worry, we'll be quick," Zig said as he reached the old garage in back. It had vintage swinging wood doors. This is what we came for?" Nola asked. Now Zig was the silent one, grabbing the padlock on the garage doors and pulling out a key. Nola glanced back at the house, giving it one of her good, long stares. Every window was dark. There's no way she knew what she was walking into. "No one lives here, do they?" Zig turned. "How do you—" He shook his head, knowing better than to ask. With a twist of the key, the padlock popped and Zig tugged open the garage doors, revealing the back of a shiny black car that at first looked like a station wagon. But as the moonlight hit it, "A hearse?" Nola asked. "How do you know no one lives here? The place smells like death." Turning back toward the beautiful old house, she added, "It's a funeral home, isn't it? One of Delaware's oldest. There's a sign on the other side of the house. When they're busy, I pirate here."
"Pirate?"
"Sorry. When there's a big disaster, like a traffic accident with multiple deaths, a local funeral home will get so overwhelmed, they can't handle all the bodies. So they'll call in a pirate," Zig explained, using the nickname for roving embalmers. When Zig first started in the industry, it's how he got experience, floating from funeral home to funeral home, community to community. The joke is, when you pirate around, you're kind of like death himself. Nola stared at him.
"I always thought death was a she."
Zig let that one sink in. "Anyway, when it's winter in the Middle East, fighting season winds down, so there are fewer casualties among our troops. When Dover gets quiet, I'll sometimes add a few hours and moonlight here after work." Nola turned back to the garage. "Tell me why we need a hearse. You said Horatio's in Alaska. I checked the schedule. The flight that brought the bodies to Dover is finally headed back. If you want to be on it, we have to first get you on base."
"Dover won't stop a hearse?"
"Of course they'll stop a hearse. It's a military base. They stop everything. Scan your IDs, mirror under the car, pop the trunk. But even when they search the trunk, there's one place they'll never check." Inside the garage, Zig pulled the string for an overhead light. In front of the hearse, up on a rolling church cart, was a 7-foot-long box, shiny cherry veneer, antique bronze hardware. A casket. Nola looked like she was about to take a half step back, but she stood her ground.
"All you have to do is lay there," Zig said, raising the casket's head panel and pointing inside.
Cream velvet interior. Nola studied the coffin for a solid 10 seconds. Her lips were pressed together in a thin, flat line. As always, she had that blazing focus, like her eyes were microscopes, able to see down to the molecular level.
"Nola, if you don't want to do this, I can do it."
Committing to the cause, she climbed inside the coffin and leaned back into resting position, as if she'd done it before.
"Shut the lid, Mr. Zigarowski. I'm not missing that plane."